top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die, only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 326 of the Really Awful Movies Podcast. Happy Death Day. Now, as has been the thrust of recent episodes, real life, broadly speaking, has informed podcast content going forward. So my birthday just passed, and as long as I don't anytime soon, or at least in the next 40, 50 years, I'll be a happy camper. It was my birthday a couple weeks back, and my employer is usually quite diligent about these things in terms of giving out donut treats and sourcing, you know, sugary cakes for such occasions. Forgot, and I don't begrudge them or hold it against them, but one of the many silver linings, I think, to working from home is not having to endure the societal spectacle and awkwardness that is standing there while someone sings happy birthday to you, which is unbelievably awkward. I mean, how is one supposed to deal with this? Put your hands in your pockets, whistle, I don't know, I find it an incredibly awkward song. And speaking of songs, one that I've been listening to is 16 Tons, Tennessee Ernie Ford. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. Well, the debt problem hasn't followed me around, but definitely 1 year older and not sure if I'm any the wiser. Now, when it comes to the production team behind Happy Death Day, well, it's Blumhouse, and I don't know how you guys feel about it. I think their output runs the gamut from mediocre, and that would be Oculus, Paranormal Activity, to the good, but not the great. And I would throw in Get Out and Sinister. They're very, very good efforts, but this production outfit has failed to put out anything great, and Happy Death Day is, frankly, right in the middle. Maybe a little leaning towards the latter, but Christopher Landon is part of the Landon family, and I believe son of Michael, Little House on the Prairie, and that he was tapped to direct this effort as he was responsible for some of the even more forgettable, I would say, Paranormal Activity sequels, none of which I've admittedly seen, but if it's based on the source material, the original, it's nothing I would deem to regardless, but you know, Blumhouse put their money behind this, you know, occasion-based horror effort. Occasions are prime candidates around which you can launch a marketing campaign and marketing materials, and it runs the gamut from something straightforward and rather obvious of, let's say, Halloween, the eponymous holiday around which the John Carpenter's effort is based, to something more obscure like the original Wicker Man, and the remake too, but around May Day, you got your April Fool's Day, you got New Year's Evil, even something as banal as Bloody Wednesday. So maybe some people think Wednesday is an occasion, and to the extent the days haven't blended together like like certain scotches during the pandemic, I mean, hell, Hump Day, that's fine fodder for a horror movie as well. But Happy Death Day, obviously, birthdays are something we all share and treat with reverence or dismissal in equal measures. I think the older you get, probably that people can relate on that front. Tree is an undergrad at fictional Bayfield University, which is meant to be in Louisiana, but seems to be way too palm tree ridden and sunny to be from the bayou, but I think it could be somewhere in California or something. But she is an undergraduate who is having an affair with one of her professors, a tacky, pretty tacky, but that provides a little bit of interest, narrative interest that could have been maybe better developed. But she is forced to, a la Groundhog Day, to which this is frequently compared, live the same day over and over and over and over and over again, which could be an extended metaphor for the COVID pandemic and the inability to properly delineate between, well, work and life, insofar as work seems to encroach so much on your life when they can't control you in person. I'm not calling out my employer in that regard. I think that's what's happening in a lot of workplaces, as employers are finding out that the necessity to see one another face-to-face has been grossly overstated, shall we say. Tree faces a series of nightmares from which she wakes up, not to the strains of I Got You, Babe, the execrable Sonny and Cher hit a la Groundhog Day and Phil Connors and Bill Murray, but to her dad ringing her up to wish her all the best on the auspicious day. And she wakes up in the dorm room of a character named Carter, with whom she might have or might not have had a drunken dalliance the night before. It's revealed slowly later on that they didn't, and they're the twosome in which the audience is meant to more heavily invest. And Tree is, it should be said, wonderfully portrayed by Jessica Roth, who was in La La Land. I'm not familiar with her work, but she's in her 30s and very capably and charmingly playing a decade down in age as the protagonist. This movie has also been compared in the same breath to Scream, and to the extent that it's one of these ironic, self-referential type films, I think that's probably a fair point of comparison. However, I'd probably link it thematically more in line with the 1950s film noir of DOA, where the protagonist in that film is poisoned and has to solve his own murder effectively as the toxin is coursing through his veins and he's only got so long to live. So that one at least puts an endpoint and a coda on the protagonist's life here, whereas a Tree and her misadventures in the subconscious keeps waking up and waking up and waking up and waking up, being stalked by this mysterious figure wearing this laminated mask. And this Bayfield University, for whatever reason, doesn't have your standard Southern U.S. or varsity mascot. The typical gator, cougar, lion, tiger, bear, that kind of thing, or fighting this and fighting that. It's, I don't even know what it is. It looks like some sort of weird doll. It doesn't really, I'm not sure what kind of point they're trying to make, but I guess this is a very, this is a campus that's infused with all things Greek, all things frat and sorority, and I believe Tree is part of the sorority sisterhood as well, and again, given par for the course, as I think creatives who come up with these kinds of things always look askance at sororities and fraternities with, I think, a lot of justification, but also I think that as loner creative solitary writer types, they I think these kinds of Greek organizations fill them with envy, to be perfectly honest. I don't think, not in every respect, but the camaraderie and the easy breezy means by which they fraternize, well, there you go, from the Latin for brother, right? Fraterna. But it's that kind of easygoing ease with which they socialize with one another, I think, is the bugbear of a lot of solitary journalist writer types. So I think, but again, a lot of their obviously hazing rituals have put them, I think, quite rightly in the spotlight for behaving in a very backward and brutal ways. And I think the Me Too movement is probably causing a lot of sleepless nights to a lot of frat dudes. Anyway, the dynamic, again, between Carter and Tree is really, really what drives this thing forward. And he's kind of a timid, reticent, I guess, friend zone type fellow, although he's well-meaning. And he wakes up to see her just in an increasingly erratic and bedraggled way, as she gets up from a hangover and then has to run and go about her business every day, and then until she, I guess, finally realizes that, much like, again, the rest of us are doing in COVID, she's reliving the same day over and over and over again, although for the purposes of the narrative, obviously with some means of variation. Now, it's an interesting conceit, and Blumhouse, I think, has tried this kind of thing before with the conceptual framework that you have to wrap your mind around, and it's a kind of a logical leap that you have to be on board with in order to find this type of film successful. I think it's not in the case of The Purge and its subsequent sequels. I think, even as a fan of dystopian movies, I think that premise and that conceit is, you know, dumb as a box of rocks, and I was never able to really, really get behind it. It shares some similarities with Happy Death Day, with some of the masks and some of the aesthetic look, which I think there's a certain sameness to some of the Blumhouse films, but I don't think that succeeds to the extent Happy Death Day does, if you're on board with this conceit. And really, there's no, you just have to accept it as is, and it's fantasy, it's like Groundhog Day, it just is what it is, and you have to roll with the punches. Now, you're, wading into dangerous territory, or into dangerous waters, to not mix my metaphors, if you're going to align yourself with the likes of the Harold Ramis-directed Groundhog Day. I mean, this one is, I think, a masterclass in dark, sinister, existentialist humor. I think it's one of the greatest films ever made, and not 2 or 3 months goes by where I don't think about some aspect of it, whether it's Ned Ryerson, or the puddle, or the alarm clock that Bill Murray endlessly wakes up to, and that execrable tune, I Got You Babe, but also his frequent attempts to off himself. And that's something that Happy Death Day engages with too, although with not nearly as crackerjack a script. But you do have this tree character downing a bunch of pills and generating a little bit of comedic capital out of her knowing events that are going to transpire far in advance of them. And this is played out in the center of campus, where she emerges in a walk of shame. I don't know, does that still exist? I feel like this is loaded language now, but I think it's still a thing. But she goes out into the campus, and there's a frat pledge who teeters on the and falls into a crumpled heap due to exhaustion or God knows what, and also a sprinkler system that routinely goes off around the same time, you know, wetting a bunch of co-eds in the quad. And this is played for yucks throughout as she engages with this goth who gives her the once over and looks her form up and down, and but also is played for kicks when she Lady Godiva is it through campus, getting into her altogether and just wandering around, when she finally does realize that, oh, there are no real consequences to her actions. And this, knowing that she's going to wake up to the same day again, it kind of plays into that Greek myth from the Ring of Gyges, and that conceptual experiment. I believe it's Socratic. It could be could have predated that. I'm not certain, but this conceptual thought experiment in which you don the Ring of Gyges, which gives one a cloak of invisibility, and you have to ask yourself the moral imperative as to how one would act, knowing that no one can see what you're up to and can keep you and hold you account for your actions. So yeah, the Ring of Gyges, it comes into play here. The director Christopher Landon is smart enough to include a bunch of possible red herrings, but also suspects who could want this beautiful young woman no longer to be with us. But the obvious one would be the fact that she's involved with one of her professors, and he's hiding this illicit affair from his put-upon wife, and I guess she's taking pre-med classes and he's teaching some kind of a neurobiology class or some such thing. But there's also a message in Happy Death Day insofar as when people take stock of another year that's passed, they frequently are in the self-improvement and betterment mindset. I was just reading a study today talking about the surge in search engine traffic for self-learning and self-directed learning as we've gone through lockdowns from the spring until now, and how people are taking it upon themselves to better themselves through all manner of things, whether it's learning another language through maybe a Duolingo or adopting certain hobbies that they heretofore would not have engaged in, whether that's woodworking or knitting or I don't know, yoga or some such thing. But people do take stock of how their lives have passed over 365 days. I can't say that I have this year to any significant extent. My birthdays in the past have been thoroughly unmemorable, and I would count this year as well, only as a caveat because I don't typically celebrate it on the day itself, but usually gather around some mates or some friends to go out for a few beers and toast another year of my existence. But this one, nothing really. The limitations of not being able to do much of, frankly, anything other than, patronize a favorite curbside pickup restaurant on the go kind of offering. So nothing really, and maybe down a couple beers. That was about it. But this one has instructive, normative, instrumental, metaphors and denotations and connotations, and toward the end these are built upon, where Tree realizes that she's been a sort of solipsistic, selfish sort, and that a la Phil Connors in Groundhog Day, living the same banal day in and day out, in the case of Groundhog Day, played for really fun laughs as Connors memorizes a bunch of arcane French poetry, but also masters the piano and really behaves like he's in the midst of COVID and tries to improve himself so he can look better in the eyes of his paramour. To a certain extent, this happens as well, but it's almost an afterthought because the movie plays its hand a little bit insofar as the relationship between Carter and Tree is so compelling right out of the get-go that they don't really need her to really improve herself in his eyes anyway, because he's just really a smitten puppy dog. And we're going to segue into what I learned here for Happy Death Day. This is a movie that I think has a premise that could have, around which something a lot more meaty could have been built. I mean, there's a lot of depth that it could have explored that it really didn't, instead taking a more glib and tongue-in-cheek, knowing approach to the material and taking a more scream-like approach. I think it does itself a disservice. Not to mention the fact that tonally it's just so at odds with the existentialist horror that comes from living the same day in and day out, which could be obviously a metaphor for prison, whether it's the mind-forged manacles. I believe that's Yeats, is it? I can't tell, but it could be a prison of one own's making anyway. If not, it could be you could be in actual prison, living the same day in and day out with your yard time and your commissary times, and the same time you get breakfast, same time your cell is searched and all this kind of thing. But it's a type of existential dread that could have really benefited from a much darker, not only humor sensibilities, a la the depths to which I think, and heights, I should also say, but the depth to which Groundhog Day, I think, effectively really explored this kind of conceit in a way I think Happy Death Day doesn't quite. I think that would have made for a more interesting film than a woman who merely has to adapt to living the same day over and over again, in which she, and frankly, she improves already, speaking of self-betterment, living that same day over and over again and improving on it every time. So she gets better and better at hiding from her antagonist. And really, if you were to live the same day over and over again, and this was your biggest concern compared with Phil Connor's concerns over his mental health deteriorating, one could just spend the morning enjoying coffee, showering, maybe there's no real timeline put on it, but you could enjoy one of your favorite pieces of literature or music, and then just roll over to the police station and just hang out with your friends so that you're adequately protected from whatever psychopath is stalking you. I mean, there's enough ways out of this that narrative outs, you could call them, in a way that the squares were circled, or circles were squared, I don't know, however way you want to put it, in a much tighter and more self-contained, circumscribed Groundhog Day film. So another thing I learned while we're on the subject is I'm always, you know, looking out for things like geography, but also mise-en-scene. And there are frequent nods to the, speaking of John Carpenter, I mentioned earlier, but They Live, there's a poster in one of the dorm rooms, which I don't think would really merit having a poster. I mean, I think it's just purely as a means of self-aggrandizement for the people behind this production, because if anything, there would be the more ubiquitous Pulp Fiction or Reservoir Dogs, and maybe the Bob Marley one. These are like the long-standing cliches of the dorm room aesthetic design considerations, but I don't think anyone is going to be as good as They Live was, and as seminal and important a film as that was, I don't think it has that kind of cachet even amongst the cool kids in cinema studies. But so that's another thing I learned. There's various, I think the camera captures that 3 or 4 times. We're like, yeah, we get it, we get it. We get that you're influenced by They Live, and that there's much more potentially going on here than once you scratch the surface, if that even can be said. But another thing I learned that, I mean, sorority sisters are, they still fat shame even up to this day. I did not know that. The one member of their ranks who's not even, like, barely above normal BMI. She's just a normal girl, really, and she's called out for being a chubby and chastised and derided for, I believe she had chocolate milk on her tray. It's just the kind of really petty, silly, immature kind of behavior that one would think you'd have outgrown by the time you've passed your SATs and matriculated. Is that the word for going into university? I think so. You would think that kind of behavior would be left behind, but then again, when you're playing beer pong and funneling beer in the local I Felt a Thigh fraternity, maybe I'm expecting too much of Gen Z, but Animal House, is that still a thing? I don't know. Another thing I learned, that this film has some pretty good aesthetic sensibilities at times, but it doesn't really, the humor doesn't match the gravitas of the subject matter, nor, it should be said, does the gore. I think this film could have really benefited from ratcheting up the gore and maybe standing in contraindication to the typical Blumhouse effort by aiming for a more, I guess, a deeper level of bloodletting. And I think it's par for the course for this production house not to do that. I think it's a mass audience consideration, but this would have really, really benefited from, again, a darker, more morbid, more gallows humor type script approach, but also maybe a little bit darker and sinister kills, because tonally I think that could have played well off one another, because this one has a very jokey tone and you never get the sense that she's in any real particular danger. The denouement is somewhat unsatisfying, though I don't want to particularly spoil it, but You don't see it coming, but it also can't necessarily be wrapped up with a nice tidy bow and doesn't make overt, coherent sense, at least in my eyes. I would have to rewatch it, and I'm not one to do so, I don't think. But that's not saying there's not enough to commend Happy Death Day. I mean, it does have a certain something. It has occasionally crackerjack, sharp repartee. And again, the Jessica Roth is just such a... she's such a great, she's so great in this role, and there's one person in whom everyone is so invested, you can't have a film without someone who's that capable, and capable she is, and so her performance, I think, just really propels this into another level, although I'm going to only give it maybe a more tepid recommendation, but I'm going to give this a solid 3.25 out of 5. Just a reminder that while we're fully ensconced in the Christmas holiday season, if you can, help support the show. Oh, there's my cable guys are out at work making sure my internet is all stable and everything, so apologies for that. But if listeners could pick up a copy of Death by Umbrella, the 100 Weirdest Horror Movie Weapons, that would really help the show. If you're a fan of Troma, you'd really dig it. Lloyd Kaufman has written a really fun foreword, and it's a book that Jeff and I are really proud of, and are also proud to say hasn't dated much, despite it being released in 2016, because it's as comprehensive a unique kill repository and tome as you'll ever see. And I don't think we missed a beat on that one. And it's for fans of us as writers, we've also dived into the mass market nonfiction space again, but in a different genre category, with all things action and all things chewing on toothpicks and sinister glowering and roundhouse kicking through minds bigger than yours, the 100 wackiest action movies. Hell, pick up a copy of both of them. They make great Christmas gifts, or in keeping with the theme from today's show, birthday gifts too. And I see these guys are really drilling up a storm here, so I'm going to have to vamoose, but I shall talk to you soon. All the best over the holiday season, and take care.